Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Nick Bantock, author of The Corset and the Jellyfish, A Conundrum of Drabbles, published by Tachyon. It was released in November of last year. Nick, as pretty much everybody knows, is the author of the Griffin and Sabine trilogy, its follow-ups, The Notebook, The Golden Mean, and the Morningstar trilogy. And he's written a total of 30 books, and I guess now more. And with The Corset and Jellyfish, we are, or at least I am, confounded by a book that somehow seems to include me as part of it, and that was found in an attic in North London. And as far as puzzles go, I mean, this is not Wordle. It's hard. So there's 100 stories, each 100 words long. Today's world might be called flash fiction or something like that. And my challenge and yours is to construct a missing tale by deconstructing glyphs, sentences, perhaps letters, and to add a 101st tale of 100 words that may unlock a secret to, I don't know, life, the universe, and everything. So welcome, Nick, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good day.
So how did it come about that you found this work?
Oh, do I start down that road or do I cut right across?
That's why I asked it that way.
So let's okay, can I do two things at once? Okay, so a number of years ago, I did a book called The Egyptian Jukebox, which was 10 drawers that were part of something that was literally an Egyptian jukebox. The idea was that you, in your imagination, pulled the drawers out, and as you pulled out each drawer, you would see this series of objects set on a painted background. And with each of these was a story and then a page of clues, which was supposedly set up by this character called Hamilton Hasp. And the idea was that you were meant to get one element from each of the drawers, add them together, and you would get the solution to the Egyptian jukebox. I loved doing that book. It was so much fun. It came about in such a sort of a bizarre way that I won't bother to go into detail, but it kind of stumble-bummed its way into existence on the back of Griffin and Sabine. For many years, I didn't do any more of those kind of books. And then a few years back, I decided to have another go, one that used the sort of the physical envelope technique of Griffin and Sabine, but those envelopes were to house another mystery. And that was called Dubious Documents. So having created those first two, when it came to doing The Corset and the Jellyfish, I proposed to the publisher a series of 100 drabbles, 100 word stories. They felt that there needed to be a hook. I don't always necessarily agree with the way publishing has gone about luring the audience in. It's partly because I think the audience is underestimated. When I go back to Griffin and Sabine, I was told that the original print, I was surprised they would print it. Two, everyone felt that the print run of 10,000 was ambitious. And by Christmas that year, it had sold over 1 million, which told me that the publishing world didn't really fully know its audience. They didn't know who was out there and what people were interested in. And I think over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen more and more, as publishers have become financially driven, as they have to, the small ones to survive, the large ones just because they just want to get bigger and bigger and eat each other up, They rely on a system of algorithms and also marketing in such a way that they try and see what was successful a few months ago and then replicate that. And so the decision making comes from the top down. So by the time you get to the author editorial process, you're not necessarily getting something that is always challenging or feeding the reader what they might be wanting. It's based much on what they did want or people assumed they wanted. So to return to the corset and the jellyfish, I really just wanted to get 100 word stories out there. And I wanted to do that because I felt it was really necessary these days. I mean, I'm sure you've been subject to the same thing of getting emails and texts where you read it and you go, I have no idea what they mean. You know, it's so poorly written or so ambiguous. And I feel that we've become so short form oriented that we, to some extent, have lost our ability to be exact about words, but also to tell stories in a concise way. A 100-word story is very challenging because you still have to write a beginning, a middle, and an end. And to do that in 100 words is, it's fun. It's a great challenge to do it. So this book, not only did I want people to get to read my stories, maybe at bedtime, and just before they go to sleep, but I wanted to actually challenge people to actually write them themselves. So this game I set up at the beginning of the book, which the publishers were keen on, and you know, is happy to do, is really a way of leading people in to write their own story. So one, if you know anything about sort of mathematical possibility, if you take, there are 100 stories and you could take one word from each of 100 stories, it's mathematically exponential. It's almost as many as there are stars out there. Yes. So it's an impossible task. Because, and once you realize it's an impossible task, you realize that you can actually, when it comes to doing your own stories, you can put the, you could systematically go through and pick a word from each of the stories and try and build it. But it'll be far easier to just actually write your own story.
So what I'm
telling you is that I'm teasing. I'm playing the game of trickster.
Nonetheless, well, let's go back to the original question. And you can answer it, as you said, a couple of ways. So this book was found in an attic of sorts.
Yes, it was. I found it. Which part of my imagination I found it in is, you know, kind of neither here nor there. But it was a discovery within me. And the fact that I would make that into a tactile form to make it more accessible, it seems to be what authors and writers and even artists have done for thousands of years.
Yeah, I found that in my dreams primarily, that the subconscious is in fact a house. It may be your house one night and maybe someone's house or maybe a house you thought you had. And in that house are many rooms and many cabinets.
Yes. Well, so I also had the same, not long before the course it came out, actually around the same time, I had a deck of cards come out called The River. I previously had a deck of cards called the Archeo. And the Archeo was it's 40 archetypes, and it's a tool to help people establish and understand the various characters within them. Anyone who's tried to do any writing knows that you have to be honest to voice. And you have to find the person within you if you are to give true expression to that character and allow the voice to come out. And you can use any technique you like. You can use Gestalt therapy, where you sit down in one chair, speak from that character, move, do another. When I wrote Griffin and Sabine, I did it by having the two characters have their own pens and their own chairs, and they had their own way of writing. And then as more characters came in, so each of those were given that. So I found ways to actually enter my own internal archetypal universe and to have dialogues within there.
Well, since you've mentioned Griffin and Sabine a couple of times now, let me ask you a question. And I don't know if it's true or not, but I've read that one of the inspirations for Griffin and Sabine was Yeats's Second Coming.
Yes. And
if that's true, well, first of all, you know, I'm obsessed and have been obsessed with What Rough Beast. And so since you began Griffin and Sabine, here we are, I don't know, 30 some years later, more. So things have changed so much.
Yeah, sure.
But that Rough Beast, in my opinion, is like almost there.
It's absolutely in the center looks like it's completely failing to hold. Yeah, that poem to me, when academics analyze it, break it down, and they tend to do that historically, I think they fail to realize how current it is, how extraordinarily deeply rooted in humankind's psyche, and how brilliant Yeats was to actually put it in that form, because it seems to, as each age goes past, as each new generation comes along, it seems to reform itself in a way to make sense to them.
And there's so many cultural icons that have drawn from it, whether it's The Center Cannot Hold, and one of the most famous books of this century, last century. And then, you know, even musical groups. And it's like, as you said, it's so current that you can pull lines out of it that certainly in America express the lack of civil discourse, the lack of the ability to reason, the idiocracy, if you will.
Yes. And it is, although it's couched in a language that is, you know, so tightly mythological, it is actually not that difficult to comprehend. I mean, the thing that frightens most people, I think, from poetry of that period is it's almost like they fear getting lost in it. It's some kind of agoraphobia. But you're not that. I mean, the idea that there is this beast underneath us moving under the surface of the desert that might at any point sort of rise up and rise out. For me, it doesn't have direct religious connotation. It's much more to do with the sort of the rise and fall of civilization.
Well, then, if you turn to this book, I don't like using the word whimsical, but you know what I thought of? I thought of Italo Calvino's Cosmic Comics. And some Borges. But the funny thing is that I'm saying, okay, I wonder what the inspiration here is. But I think it is, the inspiration is that, like you said, one of the rooms, one of the keys, one of the cabinets in your mind. I don't think there's an outside inspiration unless you can tell me that there is.
No, I think you're dead right. And so sort of going back to where I was sort of rambling towards was this deck of cards that had come out called The River, which is, it's an internal landscape. The cards are designed, they're very open-ended, they're very strong imagery. But the idea is to help teach or encourage people to use their visual imagination or stroke their intuition as a direct means of understanding the way their life works. In other words, when we dream in a series of pictures. We don't dream in words. What our culture tends to do is to translate images into words before we can understand them or before we try to understand them. And then you have to, so the logical process is one of a kind of slow zigzagging. It's not as step by step as it pretends to be. Whereas the world of Visual intuition allows you to go from image to image to image to image, as in your dream or your fantasy life. So what I encourage people to do is to actually trust that intuition. It's sort of, you know, for want of a better term, it's the same intuitive way of perceiving the world and solving things that got witches burnt. You know, well, female intuition is a direct threat throughout the history of our culture. And that's, you know, that has been something that has handicapped us as humanity because of our inability to feel comfortable with the anima and the animus, the male and the female, all of those internal aspects that have got nothing to do with man and woman, but are to do with the internal balance of our perception.
Well, then if you go to the title story, and each of these is a story, as you said, with a beginning, middle, and end, it may seem to some people just absurdity, nonsensical. You have a woman in a dress, you have tattoos, and you have a husband who's entranced by them, but you want to parse out meaning from that, and maybe you can, and maybe it reminds you of something that happened in your life. But each of these is, you could call them magical realism, or you can call them fun, or you can call them absurd, as I said, or you can call them, as I said, you could call them, some of them, whimsy.
They're meant to be a release. Jung said there's no creativity without play. And the playfulness here is designed to free the mind from thinking it knows. You know, when you let go on I know or I should know or guilt or ought or shoulds or any of those things, and you just embrace possibilities and you play with them, that's the nature of, you know, my background is fine art. I didn't start writing until I was 40. So I come from an arena, a visual arena, where you're playing with images all the time and letting them speak to you. When I engage with a painting, I begin by just putting marks down. But as it progresses and I sort of slow down and start to look at and listen to what's in front of me, it starts to tell me what it needs.
I was going to say, some of the reviews imply that there's a haphazard ordering. And then I thought, I don't know whether it's haphazard. All I know is these images are all pointed, both literally and figuratively.
Yes.
Each of them. I thought, okay, maybe that's the clue. Maybe they're pointed in the direction of one word. But I'm entitled to do that. I'm the reader. But in any event, was there, and you are an artist, and was there some conscious, or perhaps you don't know, but perhaps some subconscious reason for pairing each of the glyphs or each of the pictures with the story on the opposite page? And they're beautiful. They're beautiful illustrations and beautiful colors.
Think of that as the absolute diametric opposite of what you've just described. It's not to be specific. They are not paired, but they are actually spaces, and they function in the same way that the visual world functions with our thinking process. In other words, it comes in a series of relatively random flashes. If anyone closes their eyes and, you know, in a dark room, you will start seeing images run across the back of your eyelids. That's, you know, that's how we perceive things when there is nothing else coming in, which is very similar to the nature of our dreams. So I approached these images that I mentioned the tricksters before. They're mischievous little characters that give you a breathing space between the stories, but they prod and poke you. They're meant to sort of distract you from your logical and reasoning thought process to make you more open to the notion of story as an expanding thing, you know, like the little dinosaur you put in water and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Each of these stories, they're so concentrated and compressed, if you sit with them, they'll grow and grow and grow. And any one of them could have been a novel.
Well, since you mentioned the trickster and you mentioned archetypes, and now you're talking about Jungian archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
And did you rely on those at all in the construction of the?
They have been so much part and parcel of my
life. Me life too.
Experience that I couldn't separate them out if I want to. It's how I perceive the world. I mean, one of the things I try and teach when I'm helping people with their art is, don't get trapped into reproducing what you did yesterday. Picasso said, I'll steal from anyone but myself. The idea being that each day you start a new piece, you step into the studio, don't feel burdened by what you did yesterday. Allow yourself to be open. Galleries and the pressure of selling yourself online and all of those will try and get you to repeat yourself. But in my experience, a healthy psyche comes from actually being willing to try something new constantly and keep allowing yourself to expand your peripheral vision.
Well, if we continue then with the stories, and there's so many of them, I mean, obviously we're not going to go through 100 or a fraction.
Yeah.
One like The Fallen Rocket, which resonates with me because how much I love science fiction. You have a story in which a rocket is abandoned and rusted, and the villagers try to salvage pieces of it for their own use. And then an alien race comes and says, oh, we have to take this home.
Yeah.
But they feel bad leaving it. Listen, this is more than 100 words explaining it. And they feel bad about leaving it. So they leave behind a little gift that you might put on someone's doorstep when they move into your neighborhood. But you can't leave a gift like that because we don't have the capacity to do it. And then I'm going, okay, that was very interesting. And it did have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And now it's making me think. But then I think, wait a minute, it doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so let me tell you where it came from. Not that it's going to explain it, but I came across a little tiny, tiny photograph, no more than about an inch square, of an early 1900s water tower in the Midwest that had collapsed and fallen over. And going past it were a couple of people. They're ignoring it. So I decided to do a drawing. So I took this little tiny photograph and I started doing a drawing that was about 10 inches wide, about 8 inches high. And it was a drawing of this water tower. I pushed the photograph aside after a short period of time and just worked on the drawing. Well, the drawing is a very slow process. And it probably took me 80 hours, say. Well, you imagine while you're sitting there drawing, very slowly building up the graphite, a story evolves. It just comes out of the image. And by the time I'd come to the end of it, I just wanted to write the story down. So I wrote the story down, but I didn't want to write the whole, a whole long short story or a novella. I just simply wanted it sharp and clean. So it seemed perfect that it would be, come in the form of a drabble. So the images created the words, not the other way around. And in our word-based society, we have a tendency to assume that the words are more significant than the so-called illustration, because the illustration is subservient or derivative. Whereas I come from a background where it's actually, I see the image as being more important. And that the words are just a way of moving on from there. So when I did, I'm speaking very fast, I realize, but when I did Griffin and Sabine, people asked me which came first, the words or the images. Well, they came together. An image would suggest words would suggest an image. And so they grew and built off each other from the center outwards. It wasn't.
No, that's different, because Griffin and Sabine is more than just images and words. It's, ephemera. It's also the postcards, the stamps, are an integral part. So it's like it's all constructed together. This is not the same case. This is a pic. This is what I think you're implying. A picture is worth a thousand words, and it is. But the question is whether that picture on the left hand side is, and I can't say a thousand words, 100 words, is that picture on the left hand side evocative of the writing on the other side? And I don't mean to be silly, but you're saying no, it's not at all.
It's not directly. It's not, you don't look at that picture and say, what does this image have to do? See the book in a broader way. See the book as something that is a flow. I mean, I even go as far as to say that, you know, from my perspective, all of the books I've ever done, and I think of it as one thing. You know, it's like now that I'm this age and I look back and see what, 35, 36 books or whatever it is, they're actually one big long extended thing, and you can pull out each one. But it's like, you know, you've got your record albums and you pull a record album and you put it on, but that doesn't define your musical taste. What defines your musical taste is your record collection. Your library, exactly. So an author produces, you know, X number of works. That in a way is one work. Now, some of it is more pertinent or powerful than others. So if you take that kind of an image and then you come back to the corset and the jellyfish, these little characters that separate the stories, they're all part of one family, right? So they have more of a continuity in that sense than the individual stories, which go here, there, and everywhere. So in a way, they're the skewer that runs through the whole thing that keeps it together and stops it falling apart.
They are indeed a family. But, you know, let me ask you this. Since we're talking about, okay, the bookworm, which is one of my favorites.
Right.
Is it Notre Dame? The worm is going through first. Okay, when the worm goes through Cannery Row. Cannery Row is one of my favorite books, even though some people think Steinbeck's too sentimental. But I remember
rubbish. Steinbeck is a genius. East of Eden is one of the, you know, like one of the all-time great books.
I agree. What I was going to say though is in Cannery Row, I remember specifically. I can see it, and I read it when I was 12, and I'm 72, so I can remember specifically when the boys want to give Doc a present. And they take a tie rod and they clean it up. It's stainless steel and it's beautiful. And they put it in the box. And I can see that perfectly. So the bookworm goes through that, devours it. And to me, that meant a great deal to me. And then I immediately thought, I wonder why you decided, well, not you, the guy who wrote this. I wonder how that guy decided Cannery Row is the right book because there are all these books.
Okay, so the archetype who was temporarily the author, my archetype who's temporarily the author of doing it. Well, first of all, Notre Dame of Paris has always been one of my favorite stories, and I loved Esmeralda. And I was deeply fond of that, of Quasimodo. Some of the other characters are mean as hell, but that's what makes it a good story. But, you know, of course, if you know the ending of the story, it's none too happy because it really is a true tragedy. But I thought, well, what is this person who is reading through? As it happens, he's eating his way through the first story. He just can't bear to eat Esmeralda. I mean, she's too sweet a character. And in this case, we can use the word gypsy because she is described as being a gypsy in that sentence, in that period. But then what book would I have next to that on my library comes down to my own taste, my imaginary taste. And Cannery Row, what is one of my favorite books of all time, because when I read it, same as you, when I was young, it influenced me enormously. I mean, I can count on one hand the books that, you know, Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. That might have been another one I'd have put in there. But it was But the idea of those two sitting next to each other, such different periods of history, different places in the world, and yet the bookworm doesn't discriminate because the bookworm is hungry for literature.
Yeah, well, what you're saying is very true, because say you take the Grapes of Wrath, there's a moment when they're in a diner and he puts a nickel in the jukebox in order to play a song. But the nickel is the catalyst that allows the song to be played because it completes the circuit.
Yes.
And Steinbeck says that's the only time in his life that he's ever seen money serve a purpose. And as a child, as an adolescent, when I read that, not being a socialist, although I was reading Ayn Rand,
I get what you said.
In any event, what I'm saying is that could have been a 100-word story.
Yes.
That could have been a 100-word story. And why am I able now, 60 years later, to summon that, just like I can summon the bookworm now, or the story existential. Now I'm going on. Existential. The cat closes his eyes, and the mouse is gone. But yes. The mouse is gone for a couple of different reasons.
Yes. Yes. And so, as I said before, because every day I go into the studio, I want to do something different. When I'm writing 100-word stories, I don't want to be stuck with one story, qualifying, justifying, expanding, stretching it, making it to 300 pages so it can then be sold as a book. I want to tell essences. So each of these story is an essence.
Okay. Well, here's another one then. Okay, Shadows is not that, in my opinion, at all. Because Shadows is this guy who's originally really scary because he casts this enormous shadow. Yes. And then the child, because he's in a situation where he might be being bullied, he recognizes that the shadow wasn't necessarily something evil. The shadow was something to grow into. The shadow was a characteristic that you need to survive in this world. And in a way, it's heroic.
Well, that's one of the first lessons of psychotherapy, is that to engage with your shadow and not see it as something that is either an internal or an external threat, but something that you can actually incorporate to use as balance. You know, the shadow can function as a warrior. The shadow can function as a chiaroscuro that allows you to see things in full context.
Well, it's like if you look at it that way, it's not, I don't know what to say. Like, okay, a much more obscure one, say, beachwalkers. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys have been walking down to the beach for 97 years, but have they really? You don't know. And then these people they can't see them, they don't recognize them, but it does change their mood to a certain extent. And I'm thinking, okay, can I relate to this? And if I do relate to this, what is it that I'm thinking? Am I looking outside my window at the tree? That's the other thing I was thinking about. These stories create mindfulness in the Buddhist sense. You can't read them without just reading them. You know what I mean?
No, in the same way, Hirath, that story, Hirath is very close to the beach walkers, because you conjure up an image with the beach walkers, which takes you to a place or puts you in a number of times and places at the same time that is liable to bring up a sensation of memory, but it's not a specific memory, not like a memory of childhood or any, but it's a memory that you can't quite grasp, that is very so deep and meaningful. So Hirath means a time and place that you remember that wasn't really there. You remember it, but it wasn't there. And in so doing, it brings up a sense of melancholy and pathos.
And Go ahead. Sorry.
Melancholy and pathos is something that when I was in my early teens, I courted closely because it was companionable. As you get older, I think it's inclined to make some people more sad. But if you can get back that original feeling you had, where it was almost as though all things were possible, and that in the sort of the it's not sadness, but a feeling of what jumps into my head is Willie Nelson singing September Song, you know, someone later in their life, and you hear and feel that need to be present and enjoy everything that there is.
Yeah, like Warren Zevon said, enjoy every sandwich. And, you know, it's a cliche, but right now, as I said, I can look out at the trees and look at them. They radiate their essence. You know, Kurt Vonnegut told a story at his lecture, one of his lectures, and he said he had this uncle who wasn't that smart. He had a menial job, but he would take him fishing and they wouldn't talk, but they'd just sit there, not catching any fish, sit there in the sun by the bank of the river with their poles out. And he would just turn to his nephew at some time, Kurt, and say, "This is just fine."
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm going to do this is a horrible piece of blatant name dropping, but I am going to say it because it is pertinent to this moment. When Griffin and Sabine came out, it had been out for about, you know, 3-4 months. It was really sort of, you know, flying out there. And I was getting a huge amount of mail from people, just wanted to sort of write and get something back, you know, hundreds and hundreds of letters and postcards a week. And I open one envelope up one day and I open it up and it's a single page, and there's a drawing of a guy in profile with curly hair and a cigarette hanging out his mouth. And the letter simply says something to the effect of, "I am so envious of what you have done. I am merely working in 3 dimensions. You are working in 4. And I got to the end of it. And I read the signature, and it was Kurt Vonnegut. And I didn't believe it at first. I thought it was someone playing, but then I, you know, did a little research and realized it was him. Well, for someone like me who had, you know, so had first, as it were, had his sort of literary existence woken up by Kurt Vonnegut, who I felt much like I felt with Baltic Towers, that I realized that there was somebody else, or Monty Python, there was somebody else out there who was on the same wavelength, and therefore meant I wasn't completely bonkers. So the idea that I would get this letter from him was worth to me way, way more than bestseller lists or any of that stuff, because it was a if someone you admire tells you you've done well, how much justification of existence does that give you? And that's what it did for me. You
know? Yeah, and with Monty Python and with Fawlty Towers, the best show that was ever on television, and hard work with Connie Booth and he working worst. And you look at it and, you know, it's only 12 episodes, 12 or 16 episodes.
12, yeah.
And it's like, this is impossible. It's like, it's a jewel. And yet today, and then they tried to make it in all different countries. They tried to make it with Maud or whatever her name was in the United States. And it can't, it's like Michael Bolton singing Dock of the Bay. It makes no sense. Otis Redding, you know, sang the song. No one else can sing it. Just leave it be. I name dropped too. So when I was the same age, you and I were doing the same thing. I was reading some John Updike. And I didn't know anything about sex or sexual desire or all the things he was talking about. So I wrote him a letter and I said, you know, I'm not quite sure that I understand everything that you wrote. And I got a postcard back with a 4-cent stamp that said, "Thank you so much for your lovely letter. Perhaps a simple rereading will assist you."
Nice. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
He wasn't condescending. He was just, you know, giving a good.
He was encouraging you. That sort of that's like Rilke's letters to a young young writer. Is it young artist? Young artist? I can't remember that. But anyway, it's like it's the encouragement that we all need to keep on moving forward at that age.
It's acknowledgement.
Yeah. And after all, are we not, you know, sort of part of the reason we write or paint or do any of those things is to confirm our existence. I see a lot within the current generation of their struggle to feel like they're really there. You know, so they have to keep taking selfies. They have to keep doing things to confirm or qualify their existence, because it's almost as though they feel like they are in a deprivation chamber. You know, they can't or don't know what their senses are telling them. Not that either of us know that much more. It's just that because I think we came from a time when history was slightly more meaningful and part of our accumulation of information, we had context to hang the things on that we found out each day. But yeah. I think that if you have a very limited knowledge or understanding of history, you've got nowhere to hang your coat.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Einstein saying, without a basic understanding of mathematics, you have no idea how the world works.
Yeah.
And I don't have that, but I wish I did.
I acknowledge I don't know how the world works. I'm curious about observing it.
Yeah, but you and I aren't looking for likes or thumbs up or subscriptions to this YouTube channel. I don't care if anyone listens to it. I'm just enjoying talking to you, and we'll put it up. Someone may listen to it, or 10,000 people may listen to it. But that acknowledgement of their existence is crucial to them. And if they don't get that, then they are depressed, or in fact, at times they'll commit suicide. You know, it's
absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And that's why I think attempting to speak truthfully, as both you and I are doing now, I think there may only be a small audience. But if that audience is also encouraged to think and speak truthfully, to rip away those kind of bits of armor we stick in front of ourselves to inure or protect ourselves, and that we're able to embrace all the possibilities in that we can, I don't know, we can just enter into each.
Well, it's like you said about accumulation. It's like you said about accumulation of information. The metaphor I've always used is that for all of eternity, before we're born, we're swimming in this dark blue, warm sea. And then all of a sudden we pop up and we go, oh, this is kind of, but before we can even say this is kind of cool, we go back down and continue swimming forever. And the accumulation.
Like the whale in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, falling, trying to establish an identity before it hits the earth.
we have exactly the same reading history. So everything that you say, I can acknowledge because I've already read it and have enjoyed it. But yeah, I think the accumulation of information is basically why we're here. And without beating a dead horse, that's not what kids are interested in today. They're not, especially with ChatGPT, because they don't have to.
Yeah.
The information that they wouldn't accumulate otherwise is already there for them. Not for this
event. We're not knocking it. We're not trying to bolster our own. We're just saying, hey, maybe if you hear this, you know, like, don't completely see us as old farts, but just put a little toe in that water to see if you can feel it.
Yeah, but then, okay, you're telling these kids to compare. You're telling these kids that a clock can switch itself to a cat.
Yeah. There's no step-by-step process, right? You know, it's like people who go to workshops and only want technique. You know, it's like that's not what a good workshop does. A good workshop teaches you and encourages you to understand what you need, develop your own process, have a relationship with what you're creating, and ultimately let what you're creating teach you.
Well, was this book a workshop?
Well, yes, in a way, of course it is. As are all of, because my life is an ongoing workshop. You know, the idea that I will never be a master, I will always be an apprentice, is important, is radically important, because that encourages me to keep, you know, sort of pulling the walls down and looking through the windows.
Oh, there's so many things that are like that. Like you're standing on the shoulders of giants, or you're the master servant.
Yeah.
But you know, like, but then, okay, we should be going back to the stories, because we're trying to sell your book rather than just chat. So like, for example, the clown. Well, first of all, the first thing I thought was I had a clownfish. So wait a minute, the clownfish. And then I remember I had a placostomus, and he made the water murky because it was too much of a bio load, because he was big, for my 65-gallon aquarium. And then the murky water, the clown, the fact that it was impossible, that set me off on, I don't know, a thought process. It wasn't that I went down any rabbit hole to start looking up aquariums in my old placostomus, which you and I do all the time. And that's how you get to these stories. But it was this idea of, okay, this is part of my life, but why?
Just well, that lateral thinking is, you know, the sort of the allowing yourself to hop from one thing to another, and then maybe start forward when you've gone sort of like, you know, 20 places to the right and move forward from there. That expands us a so much wider view of the universe. If we have to keep treading exactly down the same path, you know, that robs us of so much of our potential as human beings. We have this capacity of imagination. Why not use it?
I have my grandson, Alec, who's 7. When he comes over, we do this imaginary game where there are sorcerers and people from another galaxy who bring treasure, and the treasure is up in the woods. One of the names of the sorcerers is Placido Domingo, and the other's name is Franco Nero. But to him, and he has problems pronouncing Placido. But in any event, when we went for treasure, before we went, we found some boxes. I bought like 100 cigar boxes in Dallas. I went to Dallas for the eclipse. So we bought all these cigar boxes. I thought they were $13 each, but it turned out they were $3 each. So I said, oh, well, this is great. I like cigar boxes, and they're beautiful. So I said, look what happened this weekend. There's boxes all over my house. How did they get here? And then one of them had a black ribbon in it, and he told me to wear it. This is when I get comments on my YouTube channel saying, why doesn't the interviewer just interview himself? And I go, well, yeah, that's not a bad idea. But in any event, so we go out into the woods.
This is the game of ping pong.
Excuse me?
This is the game of ping pong. Tell me, we're knocking the ball back to him to forward.
Who's winning? I don't know. In any event, we go out into the woods, and I've worn this black ribbon, and I pretended that the black ribbon aged me. And I started walking hunched over, and I had to find a walking stick to walk. And I said, Alec, why would you make me put that black ribbon on? And then I texted my wife and said, put a blue ribbon in the box so that I could be young again. So then the reason I mentioned this is because of the story of the towel, that she is young and vibrant and has a beautiful, strong body. Then she uses the towel, and then the
wipes off her years.
Yeah. And I thought, holy, I just did that. I just did exactly that.
Yes. Yes.
Instead of a towel, I used a blue ribbon. And I thought, okay.
But then you then asked to be brought back again, you know, with the blue ribbon. Yeah. So you acted out, you threw yourself into the part of the black ribbon, but then from that place you wanted to get back. So you know, to Benjamin Button, back from your imaginary future.
Yeah. But okay, well, that's why. So your story is sad. Your story is really sad.
Oh, it is. It's meant to be. I mean, there's one of the stories in there that is it in there? I've done another 100 word that I it probably will never get published, but I just did it for this year. Hell of it. It's called The Last Post Office. And so sometimes I forget which ones were actually in the corset and the jellyfish and which one were in this current one. But I think it was in the jellyfish. There's actually the story of my father's death. And he died from cancer in a relatively short period of time, 2 months, in which he sort of shrank right down. And the last 3 days of where he was going but not going. He was, you know, he could tell his whole being wanted to go, but they wouldn't help him along, so he had to sort of squeeze it out. So afterwards, I wanted to write something that was, as it were, a way of freeing him. So I just, you know, wrote this little piece that was about the bat's wings opening into the night. So yes, there are some of them are deadly serious, but I don't want people to sort of like put them in categories. You know, you just take each one, and if you're not comfortable with that story, move on to another one.
No, it's 100 genres. But you know, it's my mother who died a few years ago at the age of 96, died a beautiful death. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful death. And when people will come up and say, "I'm so sorry your mother died," I go, "It's okay."
Yeah.
Because it was exactly the way you're supposed to go. But she, in two words, not 100, said exactly what was going on. She says, "I'm failing."
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's exactly what's happening. And there's no sentimentality. There's no emotion. It's just...
Yeah, the flesh machine yeah, is just failing. So like, is a science fiction fan, you will know about the first Blade Runner and the last scene when one of the last scenes where he's in the rain and he hangs on to Harrison Ford rather than letting him go. And then he describes what he's seen. And then the machine stops.
Like teardrops in the rain.
Yes.
Yeah, that was, and Rutger Hauer made that soliloquy up himself.
Yes, I heard that it was like it was in the moment, which is
I loved him and that, yeah. Yeah, but you know, when you look at that, it's like, okay, just like your stories, you know, the big mystery about that is whether Harrison Ford was a replicant.
Yes, which and by never answering that, but by leaving that open to imagination, as it was something that's sort of very key when I first started writing, was, you know, and I was coming, you know, I was, how do you close things off? And do you explain things? And I just thought about how much I hated the end of Perry Mason's or Agatha Christie's, where it all gets explained. So I thought, no, I'm going to leave a big chunk open to interpretation. And years later, I would have, maybe I'd have 20 people in the room, and 20 people would have different interpretations of what was going on in a story. And I think that's fine. And if they ask me which is the right one, I will absolutely refuse to answer. Because what might work, what might be the right answer when someone's 20, it will probably be a different answer when they're 40.
Yeah, I don't, you know, the reason this crap I have in the bookstore, this on the bestseller list, Colleen Hoover and books like that, it's like, I don't even want them in the store. And I do have the luxury of some books like Prince Harry's book, Spare. I just said, no, we can't have that in here.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the few cases where autocracy makes sense, you know, it's...
Yeah, I'm perfectly entitled not to carry books, even though they would sell. So I'm losing money, but I'm doing the right thing. But you're right about the books. I mean, I don't want a book like these books that my brother likes, that, you know, they're wrapped up in a box with good wrapping paper and a ribbon, and then that's it. You're done. I want books that are...
Challenge me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, but then you get to like... remember when you said, Picasso said, I'll steal from anybody except myself. look at Halloween, you know, their masks are fine. He's a crotchety old man when they take their masks off.
Yes, yes.
That's like Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you can see my early influences of science fiction. I mean, when I was 18, 19, still at art college, I worked in the only bookstore in London that sold both records and science fiction books, both of which I adored being there. But that was my first real delving into science fiction. And it was, wow, it's like all the doors opened at once. There was so much possibility there. And it's funny, I never thought about it quite like this, but I think it was during that time that I realized being narrowed down to just doing one thing repeatedly or believing in one thing and one thing only is a death within itself.
Yes. When I became a lawyer, there was no way I was going to do real estate law. That would be so silly because every day you're doing exactly the same thing. So I decided to do medical negligence because each time you do a case, it's different. Whether it's ALS or a superior mesenteric artery infarction, each time you have a case, you're learning so much. It's never routine. And each case, you have to become as smart as the person, the doctor who was there. Granted, I forgot it the next day, but nonetheless.
Yeah, but in my case, it was, you know, when I left art college and I was looking for something to do, I accidentally, and you know, it was a very convoluted way of getting there, but I ended up doing book covers. So I, for 12, 14 years, I did book covers for most of the sort of publishing houses in London and Europe and elsewhere. And what it did was an art director, I got known as the person who did the stuff that didn't fall into genre. So they would, an art director would just throw me a manuscript or a hardback and say, do me a cover. You know, I have no idea what this is about. So I would go away and I would read it. And then I would conjure up an image that I thought was the essence of what the story was about. So that allowed me, each time I started on a new book, I never knew what I was going to be reading. It broadened my reading scope massively, but it also broadened my visual articulation because I was constantly trying new materials to, you know, see what I could cross-pollinate and come up with.
That's why I was trying to, no pun intended, paint you into a corner with regard to a correlation between the images.
Right. And
because you said that's what you did. You read the book. You wanted to compress it into a cover. Look at me as a bookseller. Everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my store does that with every book that they might buy.
Right. And I have great difficulty in buying a book if it's got a bad cover.
Me too. That's why I won't play pickleball and I won't play cornhole, if you know those games, because they have stupid names. And I'm not going to play.
Yeah, yeah. And we know we're being ridiculously prejudiced and probably harming ourselves.
Yes.
But I am prepared to wait when it comes to a book, wait for another cover to come out. And then I'll...
Oh, it's so funny how the way British covers and American covers have to be completely different.
Oh yeah, yeah. I did a pop-up book called Wings many years ago because I realized that there were no books out there explain how wings worked, you know, back then at least. So I decided to do this pop-up book, and it was, you know, I came to the end of it, and the first cover I did was for the British and Japanese and French. But then when it came to the American publishing house, no, it was no good that there was a bird in flight with a plane in the background and a butterfly. They wanted an eagle on the front. The American copy had to have an eagle because they felt that would sell more books. It wasn't relevant to what was in the book, but it's all about imagery.
Yeah. It's very true. If it's not, it's like I just interviewed a woman who wrote a book about the Daedalus Icarus story, but she reversed it. The Icarus was attempting to protect his father, Daedalus, who was building these wings. I can't remember the title, it just came out. But it's very true. It's like, and well, this cover, I assume you did the cover yourself.
Yeah, I always do.
And it's a, yeah, and as well, yeah, well, yeah, obviously. Well, so as we conclude, I guess, although I don't want to, oh, well, you know, okay, one more. Unfinished business. That's a good one because it's tough. It's a tough one because it's Shadow Diver and then all of a sudden there's a golem at the end.
Right.
And golems have always intrigued me. So there you sucked me in again. But I'm not quite sure what I was being sucked into. And speaking of sucked, then you have the vacuum cleaner swallowing the universe and the other story. Even if I don't figure this whole thing out, it still is very hard work.
But the actor, as you're obviously you understand or pretending that you don't, it's the act of pursuing that is what it's really about. It's not about conclusion. It's like finding the answer to life. It ain't going to happen. What we're doing is trying to get the most out of what is available to us within the parameters that we're given.
And like you said, the challenge is beginning, middle, and end. So these stories each are a journey, and that's exactly true. But there are 100 words. And so when you go back, you go, this can't be a journey because it's just the first paragraph, basically.
You know what the funniest thing, the best thing about writing them is when you sort of, you write down first time, you maybe 150 words, you cut it down, you get it to 103, you're working. And then you count and you've got 98 and you go, I've got 2 words. I can do so much with these 2 new words. So it makes you appreciate language in a way that I never understood before.
It's easy to cheat because you can just add 2 adjectives.
Oh, no, that's not, you will not do that. I guarantee that you will not do it because you will be so involved with trying to make this story as full as you can. You'll not take bad shortcuts.
Right. Adjectives don't add meaning. Okay, well, so last question. Why can't you swim?
Why can't I swim? I nearly drowned when I was, I think this is what it was. When I was about 3, my parents took me to a beach somewhere, and there was a drop-off where the sort of the sand comes and suddenly drops about 3 feet, and I was knee-high. And my parents were on the shore watching me paddling around, and suddenly they looked out, and I wasn't there. I went rushing down to the water, and I'd sort of gone in, and I nearly drowned, but they got me out, and I was okay. Water frightens me in that sense. I mean, I've lived on islands all my life, so I go to and fro, and I, you know, so I'm happy to. I love the bath; it's where I read. Yeah. Water's great for drinking, but when it comes to swimming, I never got over the pure fear of it. And the other thing is, I'm 6 foot tall, 150 pounds. I've been that way since I was 18. I'm dense as a brick. You know, my wife tries to convince me that everyone can float. It's not true.
But your stories have water in it. I don't know if you know it, but I mean, the 97 times they swam, the fish, there's other ones too. The book floats.
Oh, I'm not frightened of water. It's all part and parcel. I mean, you know, anyone who does astrology would immediately point to the fact that I'm Cancer and therefore, you know, an element of water. And I, you know, what is it? We're all but, you were 93% water, or you know, it's not something you fight against. It's just, it's at the end of the day, you can overcome most fears by facing them full on. I found that drowning is not something I can overcome.
No, it's because of the panic.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you were talking about, I always say it's the last question, but it never is, especially when we are playing ping pong. But I like what we were talking about earlier because it also leads to my book club. So this book will be, it's on the list, one of our book club books. And there'll be a two factions, one on one side of the table, one on the other, yeah. And they'll argue, why would he put this in? Well, it was obviously necessary that he put it in. And then they get very angry at each other, which is what I love.
Yeah. Well, they're talking it through. I mean, you know, it's what, you know, so greater political society needs is the ability to sit and talk the middle ground and expand or contract it, but don't try and drown the other side out. You know, this is, we need real debate.
Right. And in America, in our rough beast, there is no civil discourse. None. Zero.
There's fear of intelligence, and there is anger and envy and resentment, all of which have a level of justification. But you know, if a civilization can't move a headline descent towards a very large brick wall, that's where it's going to hit. We in North America, we in the West, we in the world, our responsibility is to find a way of not going over the edge.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is because of stupidity, because I'm interviewing Lionel Shriver next week, and she wrote a book called, I think it's called Mania. I think it is. About a world in which if you're intelligent, you're canceled. So you can't say stupid, you can't say dumb, you can't say brilliant, you can't say you went to Harvard. So doctors botch all surgeries because they didn't have to go to medical school.
let me throw you just one last closing thing. It's like ways of reversing things. And I've written this into this concept into another short story for the Lost Post Office. Is the idea there was a red dwarf in which they land on a planet, and the bottom line is, if I was to whack you on the head, you wouldn't feel anything. It wouldn't hurt you, but my head would start absolutely ringing. So in other words, those who inflict pain feel pain, not the person it's inflicted on.
There's a story in your book, I can't remember, that reminds me of that. See, there you go.
Oh, yeah, so that it feels like we all need to have a little bit more of an idea of that, you know, that what we do has implications, and to imagine, use our imagination to what it would feel like if that were done to us.
It's the way people interpret the golden rule, though. If you're a fundamentalist Christian and you support Trump, not necessarily mean you're a bad person. It just means you've done something. You've done something wrong in your head.
Yeah. Do you know what? I have to be so careful in that arena as a Canadian, because you know, when I was, I do Facebook, you know, from time to time as part of a connection, but I've stopped making any statements about states or stateside politics, just because the reaction is just so extreme. Yeah. You know, I can't even say I'm a Canadian, and this is my perception from the outside in terms of maybe what would be best for the world. No, that will guarantee that I will be jumped on.
That's wrong, because look at the Canadian act, the percentage of Canadian actors in the United States. You know why? Because they stand outside the United States. Just like Nabokov was, and I'm looking at it, the reason why he's the best writer in the English language is because English wasn't his first language.
Yeah. Sometimes if you have to work harder, that makes you more precise, which gets us back to the, you know, the encouragement for people to do travels. There makes you work hard at what you're doing.
Well, this was wonderful. This was, for me, like getting a letter from Kurt Vonnegut.
That's very kind of you. And I've enjoyed it enormously. The time has just flashed past.
I know. And as a ping pong game, we were just rallying. No one has either. Yeah. It's not about winning or losing.
No, it was keeping the rally going.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I hope we get to chat sometime soon.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.